minutes, 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to Nathan, driving a truck out there on the West Coast for Top Pot Donuts. How are you, buddy?
Wow.
Yeah, man, I got this. How you doing, Mark Riley?
I'm doing all right, man. How you doing?
Dig this. This is an email. Every morning I get up at 2 a.m. and go to my job as a delivery person for Seattle's Top Pot Donuts. I like donut guys.
Yeah.
Bakers. As I bop along on my route from coffee shop to coffee shop, the only thing that keeps me engaged and most importantly awake is your show.
Not the coffee?
No, I guess not. I guess we're keeping them up. Stay awake, man. Don't doze off. Don't doze off, dude. Wake up. I have to admit, I have a sweet job. Was that a pun? Yeah. My apologies. But it wouldn't be half this sweet without Sedition. Keep up the hard work. And Sam Cedar blows. So,
man isn't here to defend his bow tie.
I got nothing to do with it. I got the guy wrote it. You know, we had a public feud. It wasn't anything big. You know, it's hilarious. He doesn't. He's all right. That's just Nathan's opinion. You know what I mean? I'm not saying I'm condoning Nathan's opinion. I just thought all sides should be aired.
Yes.
But the thing is, a lot of people took it very seriously. You know, we got these emails where people are like, why do you guys got to fight? Don't you know that's exactly what the right wants us to do? It's like, relax. We're just hanging out on the radio here. It's like, this is a sign of weakness for the left. It's like, come on. We were just hanging out, having fun. This is an interesting series of emails here. Okay, here we go. The show has been so stellar lately, I've been forced to abandon Democracy Now. Wow, tough.
Hey.
All right. In its favor, Mark Maron. Okay, in its favor. Okay, right, okay, I'm sorry. He's been watching ours, and it's in favor of Democracy Now. Mark Maron, you used the Egyptian equivalent of kite when you said, quote, that program got gypped. I wasn't offended, but one time I used the swear unknowingly, and an Egyptian gal who I might otherwise have... Can I say that? Had sex with. Was very, very offended. When will you be performing in the Bay Area? All right, so I wrote back. I just looked it up. I didn't know I used it, but it says here in the old dictionary that it was derived from gypsy. It doesn't make it any better on my part, but it seems that maybe that gal just didn't want to sleep with you. I'll be at Cobb's in San Francisco April 1st and 2nd. Then he writes back, gyp derives from gypsy, which derives from Egyptian. I look forward to seeing you at the new Cobb's. Point of fact, I overcame her perception of me as a bigot, and years later, did sleep with her. Wait. Ironically, following the rather sedate sex, I felt gypped. Is that wrong? Are we getting wrong?
That's
is it wrongness? Dude, so yesterday I get a call from my a guy I've known since second grade, Riley. Do you know anybody since second grade?
Other than the media family.
Yeah, other than the media family. Yeah.
No.
Isn't that wild? Like, I've known this guy for, I guess, like what is that, like 35 years. I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but it's like, he's one of the, you know, he's a fellow Jewish guy from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's not that we stick together or anything, but I tend to believe somewhat that there is, like, when you come from a community, I don't know, am I wrong? I just feel like, you know, there's a, like, there didn't feel like there was any distance. You know what I mean? I mean, I haven't seen this guy in, like, 3 or 4 years. I've known him for, like, 35 years. And it was like, oh, that's just Dave. You know what I mean? It was like no time had passed. I guess I'm getting kind of emotional.
No, it's cool. I mean, I've known people for 35 years and up. It's just that I met them when I was, like, a teenager or whatever. And we've remained friends over time.
It's just weird to me that, like, it's such a relief when you see somebody you've known for a long time and you don't have that immediate feeling of, like, oh, man, what happened to that guy? And then you're even afraid to ask the story. You're like, you know, what have you been doing? You really want to know because I'm in trouble. You know what? I don't really want to know everything, but you could, you know, summarize it for me. That'd be good. Man, I'm feeling a little sick, and I get mad when I get sick.
I know exactly what you mean. I meant to ask you a question now.
Right.
The email about the Democracy Now, where was that from?
That was from, I don't know where. Oh, it's from San Francisco.
Oh, it is from San Francisco.
Yeah, from these listening to The Quake.
The Quake?
Yeah, I didn't want to bring up his name. Yeah, I'll just leave that between him and whether or not that woman's listening. I don't know. But I hate when I feel sick in New York, you know, because I hold the city responsible. I hold the city responsible for my sickness. It's one of the only reasons that I envy people who live in the suburbs. It's like, literally, if you live in the suburbs, you can drive to work, leave your house, and never touch anything or anybody all day. In New York, you are surrounded by spit. You're surrounded by spit and germs and flying bugs everywhere. One guy gets sick, half the city gets sick. I get on the subway or any, it's just like there, it's all over the place, and it aggravates me.
Well, it can be aggravating because things do spread. Stomach viruses, the flu, the common cold.
I didn't get that one.
Spread like wildfire in New York.
I didn't get the stomach virus. Thank God.
Yeah, knock wood.
So let's do a couple other stories. Look at this. Karl Rove is now being put in charge of, what's his new role?
He is the policy boy.
Yeah, what can they just do that, Riley?
Of course they can.
Oh, my God.
This is George W. Bush's America. He can do precisely what he wants.
He's been promoted, Karl Rove has been promoted to Deputy Chief of Staff. That means that he will be involved in all White House policy, not just politics. That's scary, isn't it? I mean, Karl Rove is already scary, but now it seems like, what, is Dick Cheney going to step down from running the neocon death cult and they're just going to bring Rove in because he's got such great ideas? What?
If I were Andrew Card, who is his chief of staff, I'd be very nervous by Rove being made my deputy.
Because isn't that sort of like the boss working for the other guy, the lackey?
Well, it's like the lackey may be looking over his shoulder watching the actual boss coming down on his head.
Yeah, I just like it. Gives me the creeps, you know. And Terry McAuliffe said that Bush knows that Rove is neither an economic nor a national security expert. He is simply an ideological strategist. Clearly, Bush thinks political manipulation matters more than keeping the president honestly informed about the state of the country. Well, he certainly doesn't want to be honestly informed about the state of the country.
He believes he's honestly informed about the state of the country, and if he doesn't, he doesn't care. I mean, at this point, he really doesn't.
He just commits to this reality that he's chosen to see as what the country is. That's the weirdest thing, is that he will not address, you know, anything that, you know, might infringe on what he sees as the reality of his America.
Well, yeah, because he believes in the God-given rightness of his view.
Right, and also, you know, he's a hell of a salesman. I mean, that's what he's trying to do. He's out there pitching. You know, he's just out there pitching the Social Security thing. Later in the show, we're going to play a little gaffe that occurred with somebody in a crowd. I'm not doing... That was unbelievable.
That was really,
completely
really
insensitive. Good. You know, I could actually, can I read the transcript? I can read the transcript of it.
Sure.
We can hear it later. He's, you know, he's out there in Nebraska pitching the Social Security. And a woman apparently is talking to Bush, stands up and says, that's good because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute to Social Security. I guess she's responding to something he said about Social Security. And the president says, you work three jobs. And this woman, Ms. Mornin, three jobs, yes. The president, uniquely American, isn't it? What? All right, let me finish your quote. I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that. And then there's applause. And then get any sleep? So there's like applause, you know, in like uniquely American. No, that's sad. And people are like, yes, good for her. She's a hero of the American workforce. No, I mean, why should a person, a single mother, have to work three jobs and then take a shot from the president? Get any sleep? That's sort of like saying, you know, like my policies have, you know, disabled your ability to function properly in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to work three jobs. One of her kids disabled. All right. He didn't bring that up. All right. So then, you know, then he says, you know, then he mocks her. Yet she walks away from it, you know, just having this experience with the president, and people are clapping. What are they? They're just like these puppets out there. How could that be good? How could people clap when the president says it's uniquely American to have three jobs as a good thing, Riley?
What scares me about working three jobs is that if you do it for too long, you won't live to collect your Social Security benefits.
But it's just so sad. She's got three kids. One of them's disabled. You shouldn't have to work three jobs in a country that is democratic and free. You know, if this is freedom, why isn't she able to make ends meet with, you know, one job that's good, that offers her coverage, that offers her, you know, her family coverage? And you're right. If you work three jobs, what time does she have for her family?
Yeah. And you have to understand, Mark, that this whole notion is around the question of a living wage. If she had one job that paid her a decent living wage, she wouldn't have to work the other two, or maybe she would work a second one. Three jobs that you have to cobble together means instantly none of them are paying you anything.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
And in a country where the disparity between rich and poor is so extreme, and to the point where, you know, there's recent polls where people are saying in response to Social Security reform that they think that the wealthiest should take the hit and, you know, and put more into the system or just give us their money.
Well, raise the maximum amount. The maximum amount now is somewhere on the order of $90,000 a year. Over and above that, you pay the same, you know, the same amount. Well, raise it. Raise it to 120. Raise it to 150.
Uh-huh.
And you know, increase and put in place a progressive FICA tax up above that. That's not impossible to do, and it would reap huge sums of money in the long run.
And I guess the real issue starting to become, Riley, is that, you know, Medicare is the program that's really in crisis, and I think we should talk about that when we come back.
Absolutely.
16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition, the highest-rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Ownership Society, my arse. But this is a neocon culture of debt. That's what it is. There's no ownership society. What about these deficits? Something keeps sticking in my head, Riley, in terms of we're about to talk about Medicare and the real crisis of Medicare and the lies and the intrigue that has gone around. But you know, I remember something from the John Dean book that I read, Worse Than Watergate, of Dick Cheney saying that one thing we learned from Reagan is that deficits don't matter. So is that just basically saying that we don't give a crap?
We don't give a crap as long as we have a conservative ideological cover for our deficit spending.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that is essentially the Reagan years,
mm-hmm.
when a conservative ideology masked both growth in government and an explosion in deficit spending.
Yeah. Now, with this Medicare, with the issue of Medicare is now that it's going to cost almost double that they proposed it was going to cost. He lied to Congress. What is the story on this?
All right. When he went to Congress with this, and of course, this is the Medicare prescription drug benefit. This isn't the entire program. This is a specific drug benefit.
Helping seniors have more control over their medicine.
Over their meds.
Okay.
Absolutely. The Bush administration said it would cost $400 billion.
Right.
Sizable amount, but, you know, within reason, Congress thought it was a great idea. They passed it. Almost immediately after the passage of the Medicare drug benefit bill, once it became law, the White House adjusted its estimates upward to $534 billion.
Right.
Now there are new estimates that say it will now end up costing anywhere, depending on how you look at it, from $720 billion to $1.2 trillion. Now, the Bush administration is being extremely cagey about how they're defending themselves.
Where did these estimates come from?
These estimates came from
the White House?
It may be the Senate Budget Committee. Let's see exactly where this did come from, because actually, the White House
Right.
It came from the White House.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, this is what the White House is saying is that the original estimate of $400 billion was from the years 2004 to 2013.
Okay.
This new estimate, which says $720 billion, covers a period from 2006 to 2015, where there's expected to be, toward the end of that period, an explosion in people taking advantage of the benefit.
An explosion of people getting old and sick?
Well, an explosion of the baby boom generation moving into retirement.
Sure, right.
So what now the Bush administration is saying, well, these numbers aren't out of whack because the $400 billion was from 04 to 13, and now these new estimates, 720, are from 06 to 15. So the extra 2 years added and the 2 years lopped off could somehow bridge that gap. Now, that's nonsense, but that's what they're trying to sell.
Wow, I just glazed over numbers with me, man. I mean, I understand it, but they just complicate things even more so people have no way of understanding it, don't they?
Well, they're complicating it so people won't fight it or accuse them of fudging the original number, which even some of their conservative allies in Congress are starting to say.
Huh.
They're starting to say they've been hoodwinked.
Okay.
Bamboozled.
Yes.
laid bare.
Yeah.
Sucker.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And, you know, people, first of all, I don't care what your ideology is. When you're in Congress, if you're fed bad information, whether it be intelligence information from the CIA or budget numbers from the White House, Congress people have a problem with that because they believe that they are the elected representatives of the American people and they're entitled to fair, free, and accurate information.
But they have a problem with it when it's found out, and God knows that if there be such an entity, that this administration certainly likes to take information that may be, you know, half-baked or completely false and work it to their advantage in hopes that they won't get caught.
Well, one of the things, Mark, that you have to realize is that in nowhere in any of this is a detailed breakdown of where these costs are going or how these costs are generated or any of that.
Okay.
They're just coming up with numbers. They came up with the $400 bill because they figured that's what Congress would tolerate. Now they're coming up with $720 bill. It could be 1.5 to 2 trillion in another week or two, depending on who's doing the number crunching and how partisan they are.
Now, what about this Republican, Nick, Representative Nick Smith of Michigan, who said he was offered bribes?
Well, that's the dicey part of all this. There are questions about whether or not the White House either coerced or enticed people in Congress to pass this bill, which would imply that they knew that the numbers were cooked and not real.
God, it's just, it's all such BS. I mean, and after the bill passed, the White House ran advertisements to promote the new Medicare law that were never, that were they were deemed illegal propaganda by the Government Accountability Office.
Yeah.
And the Medicare helpline, which officials said would help seniors understand the new drug benefits, was found to give out incorrect answers to questions at least 30% of the time. See, and that's intentional.
Well, it'd be funny if it wasn't happening to the American people. The people that are in fact paying their taxes that will, that, you know, that is funding all of this. And the bottom line here is that, that Bush really wants to, and there are people in his cabal of neocons that really don't want to see Medicare exist at all.
Right.
These mandatory programs, these, in, quote, mandatory entitlement programs, the, first of all, labeling them entitlement programs puts a negative stigma on them anyway.
They just would rather that old people have a direct deposit from their bank account to the pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly. The pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, all of the HMOs.
Right, and then when they run out of all of their money, just turn them off.
Turn,
just shut them down.
Shut
them
down.
Them.
Cut their cards and send them on their way.
The culture of death. That's what this is. The neocon death cult's culture of death.
Yeah. Well, we got somebody that, oh, okay, somebody's out in the lobby, I hear.
Yeah, Ramon's there with a test tube. We're going to talk about baby farming when we come back, okay?
Yeah, that's Jer and me. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Wednesday. Feeling a little under the weather, but getting by. Got the little, the coldness. Got the clammy coldness. A little achy, a little painy.
It's a little hot in her.
It's a little hot in here. Having some tea with lemon. Taking care of myself.
There you go.
That's what you got to do.
You got the echinacea out too, man. That's...
Yeah, I got the zinc. I believe deeply in zinc lozenges. Nothing has ever worked for me. I've tried echinacea in tincture form. I've tried, some guy said, the fish guy across the street from me said, oil of oregano. We talked about that. I didn't try that. These things, these quantum zinc tablets, those things, every 2 hours, they tend to, I think they work for me. Yeah, Kalo, the Costco ho, came in today with a box of, I think there was like 100 boxes of 94% fat-free popcorn. Thank you.
Yeah, but you see what he's popping your echinacea.
Yeah, well, he deserves it. He brought in the popcorn. That's a hell of a box of popcorn he brought in. How was it at Costco yesterday? How much did you spend? Oh, no, you don't
He's got to swallow, man.
Yeah, you're supposed to suck on those, dude.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Thank God, I guess that thing's huge.
Yeah, no, no. You just sort of let that dissolve in your mouth.
Not in your
Thank
head.
Thank you for letting me know, man.
Well, dude, I'm on the air. You know, dude.
You just spit one back into the bottle.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to read the direction. You know what? I apologize. That was my fault. Yeah, just let it dissolve in your mouth. and now try to talk on the microphone. So how was Costco?
Costco was great. And by the way, there's only 24 bags of popcorn in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, but it's like boxes, dude.
Yeah,
there's boxes.
There's 24 little packets of popcorn.
All right, here we go. Ramon brought this in wearing a lab coat. Let's go. This is Condi Rice's Palm Pilot for today, February 9th. 7 a.m., wake up in Paris. Note, Paris, every little girl's dream, excusing the arrogant policies of stupid white men. 7:10 a.m., sneak past Secret Service, go to Jim Morrison's grave and smoke a fatty.
No.
Yeah, 9 a.m., speak to Paris Institute of Political Studies. Tell them, when you disagree with Bush, do what I do. Smile, say, you're right, Mr. President. Then go home, drink a bottle of Merlot, and cry to the cats. Ah, a little Condi. 9:30 a.m., take questions from French students. Note, if someone mentions that I once said, quote, we should punish France, ignore Germany, and forgive Russia, end quote, tell them, the United States has moved on. We are now willing to ignore everyone. Everyone. You're saying what? Your name again? Excuse me? Are you talking? 1 p.m., do whatever is necessary to ingratiate yourself to the Parisians. Draw the line at dressing up like Josephine Baker and dancing the shimmy. I'd like to see that, though. Is that wrong of me?
Yes.
Okay. 5 p.m., send thank you note to Vatican officials. Say, when it comes to sacking the Holy Land, you guys are still the champs. Love, Connie. 9 p.m., take a romantic boat ride down the Seine alone. Always alone. So alone. Dude, so this guy, Ian Wilmot.
Yes.
He's a dude that led the team that created Dolly, the lamb.
The clone sheep.
The clone sheep at Scotland's Roslin Institute in 1996 has been granted a cloning license yesterday, by British regulators to study how nerve cells go awry to cause motor neuron diseases. Now, this means that they will be cloning human embryos.
Yes.
Dig that.
Now, how do you get a cloning license?
You just go down to, I think, the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Bureau of Cloning.
The Bureau of Cloning. The Bureau of Duplication.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it comes with a whole kit. It comes with a Bunsen burner, some test tubes.
Software.
And instructions. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. I don't know how you get a cloning license, but this is big stuff, and it can only happen abroad. You know why? Because in this country, we are ruled by, you know, the ideological whims of theocratic retarded people. Religiously retarded. I'm not talking about mentally challenged. There is definitely religiously retarded people here that I think want nothing more than to make the roads dirt again and go back to the point where, you know, if you have a cut on your arm, you leave bread out so it gets moldy and then put it on there. You know what I mean? These are people that want to use leeches. You know, and I'm not Garofaloing here. What I'm doing is I'm saying that the religious right is stopping medical progress. This type of cloning, where they can actually basically farm nerve cells, could really, you know, the true thing is that this Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a amyotrophic lateral sclerosis,
yeah.
They've not been able to study how this motor neuron disease works because they can't study neurons until they can take them from dead people. This provides an opportunity to actually grow neurons and see how they go awry and possibly help people with this disease that affects thousands of people around the world, you know, and maybe cure them like Stephen Hawking might, you know, he could be jogging, you know.
What's amazing to me is that there are people who think that Ian Wilmot is just going to, like, save all of these cloned cells and start making a race of babies out of them or something.
Well, I mean, that's always the fear. It's like, in that, you know, when I first read about this stuff, that there's going to be cloned embryos, there's part of me that says, well, that's creepy and weird, because I've seen enough. I'll tell you why. The reason why it's a little creepy and weird is because, in my head, it's like, why wouldn't they do some fun stuff? Like, look what we made. We made a little six-inch-tall guy. You know, it's like, let's see what the cat does with him. Hey, help me. You know,
you've been watching too many of those 40s black and white movies.
But that's it. That's where all that comes from. That's the only thing we're afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that, you know, that an embryo is somehow a person, number one, ridiculous. And the other idea is that, you know, human beings are specifically unique and that they shouldn't be exploited that way. That's the other idea. And the other thing is, what would stop them from making monsters, which, you know, in and of itself is, it seems wrong, but would be interesting. Right? And the other thing...
The Isle of Dr. Moreau.
Right.
Oh,
and also, the other thing is like, I think that we have an inherent jealousy that, you know, that this machine, the human machine, will be perfected and we will be left behind. I think that there's some part of this science that might really play into advancing the evolutionary process, okay? So on some level, the idea that it's like, well, the hell with that, because, you know, this is me and this is the best it gets. You know, I don't want it, you know, 10 years down the line, all of a sudden they're going to have a new human and I'm going to miss the boat on that. Screw that. They can't do that. Humans have got to stay at this place because we're perfect. I think there's a jealousy involved. And I think that, like, it's my fear. Like, I wait for the day. I wish that I will live through the day where I can walk in. I've said this before. Just go order a stem cell smoothie and regenerate all my internal organs and be fine and have eternal life here on Earth. But then I think, like, who the hell wants to live that long? You know, when people talk about heaven or even about, you know, living forever on Earth, you imagine how tedious and ridiculous that would be? I mean, give me a break. You'd need some rest eventually. But I digress, Riley. What were you going to say?
Well, first of all, if it's just a stem cell smoothie that would allow you to live forever, I think a lot of people would take advantage of it. But
it'd be expensive.
Yeah, I know.
That'd be a hell of a milkshake.
About a $5,000 smoothie. But, see, here's the thing that Wilmot points out, and I think it's very important for people to realize. Motor neuron disease was first characterized around 135 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, over 135 years, 95% of the cases, they don't know the cause of. Lou Gehrig, whatever other kinds of disease come from, you know, the breakdown of these motor neurons, they have no clue how to stop it, no clue how to examine it. They are really almost as much in the dark about it now as when motor neuron disease was first characterized over 100 years ago. What he seems to be doing. Now, I don't know the man.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't. Maybe he is one of those Dr. Moreau type guys. He's got a lab with all kinds of stuff that throws off sparks like Frankenstein. I don't know.
I don't know
this. The man says that this kind of research could, in some way, hasten the day when you learn more about motor neuron disease and maybe find a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease. Now, anyone who has ever known anyone with motor neuron diseases knows how debilitating they are.
Terrible.
Knows how it feels when you cannot control your body, because that's at the root of it.
Yeah.
And yet, there are people who will say, like this person from the what is the name of this woman from the British the Pro-Life Alliance based in London. All human cloning is intrinsically wrong and should be outlawed.
What is that based on, though? That's not based on anything practical. It's based on silliness.
Of course, it's based on silliness. It's based on the idea that you know the root of the pro-life movement is that, is, you know, that these embryos need to be protected because they are human. That's at the root of all this.
But yeah, if they were pro-life, if that an embryo, and first of all, we're talking about this in a specific way. We're not talking about reproductive freedom per se, but we're talking about that if they're really pro-life, to take a knot of cells, you know, which is, you know, you want to call it an embryo, call it whatever you want, but it's basically a wad of cells that, you know, if given the right attention, may become a fetus. But,
yes,
you know, initially it's just a wad of these very important cells. It could save hundreds of thousands of people. A knot of cells. It's not a knot of cells named Joey.
But see, what these pro-life people are arguing, and I'm not saying this to agree with them, but what they're arguing is that these little clusters do, in fact, represent humanity.
Yes.
That's what they're saying. So they're saying once the research is done, if you destroy them, you are destroying life. You become, in their minds, something akin to a murderer, which, of course, is absurd.
Why don't they work the math? I mean, the math is that, you know, the possibility of saving hundreds of thousands of lives versus the possibility of maybe, you know, washing down the drain a little knot of cells. You know, first of all, don't name them. There would be no
yeah, there would be none of that.
A lot of cells.
Charlie.
And they should just
crunch
the numbers. You know what I mean? Crunch the numbers. And, I just realized the other thing about cloning and about making perfect people. Imagine what a drain on Social Security that would be. See, that's
but you'd have more babies paying into the system.
Maybe.
And they wouldn't question anything.
You imagine if people never died? This would be, you know, they'd have to regulate. There'd be a lot of nasty regulation going on.
There'd be a lot of spacious exploration of space to find some other planet that would where people could live, because there wouldn't be enough room.
Well, he's working on that. That's one of the programs that he didn't cut, our president, was NASA. You know, he's got a big plan. The neocon death cult is heading out into the space like a virus to infect the rest of the universe.
Spreading freedom.
It's just an army of clones. Yeah, Dick Cheney and like a little jar full of spare hearts, and George Bush and just like shuttles full of cloned Christians.
But you know what? Cloning scares people. That's, I mean, and you don't have to be religious necessarily, but the idea of being able to reproduce something exactly like you scares me for the very reasons that you talked about earlier, because it's ingrained certainly in the American psyche by all these movies we've seen.
I'm special.
Yes.
And also the idea of creating babies without getting messy makes people very nervous. All right, it's 45:46 past the hour. We're going to talk about Ward Churchill, the professor from Colorado who made his stand last night, and impressively so. We'll talk to you in a second here on Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
On Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. There's the sound of the fax machine, which is the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. This gives us our daily rundown of all important liberal causes. Write these down. One, this year for Lent, don't give up anything. We've given up enough in the last 12 months, don't you think, people? Two, start a fake faith-based initiative just so you can get government funding. I am the holy man. Send me some money. Three, to celebrate the Chinese New Year, rent a tank and restage the Tiananmen Square standoff. Four, stop eating at tapas bars. America has to wean itself from dependence on foreign oil. Olive oil. Foreign olive oil. Wop, 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 wop. Did I screw that one up? Maybe. I think it worked. It says olive oil, and then I said foreign oil, and then it said olives. Could go either way. Okay, that's what I think. Five, today's phrase is dropping in the conversation. Hey, Bush, so having three jobs is uniquely American, huh? You know what else is uniquely American? Impeachment, man. Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. Yes. Yes. You know what they probably do, Riley? They probably clone a race of people designed to be hated.
Uh-oh.
That would be that's how they would solve the problem of hatred. Like, you know, and each family could have one. You know, don't hit your brother, hit the clone. That's what we have him for. No? All right, let's talk about this guy. I became sort of fascinated because, you know, I got to be honest with you. This fella, this professor, Ward Churchill of the University of Colorado, has come under fire because apparently he was to speak at Hamilton College. That's in upstate New York.
Yes.
It's not clear why he was speaking, but he was an academic. He does some stuff for Indian rights. He does, you know, many things. He travels. You know, he speaks. That's what academics do, and they speak at other colleges. Now, a professor at Hamilton, Theodore Eismeyer, did a little research on Churchill, found an essay that he had written on the Internet. And it has been parsed in, not parsed, but it's been sort of excerpted in the mainstream media. The essay was called Some People Push Back on the Justice of Roosting Chickens. It was a response to 9/11. Now, because of this essay, it seems that Eismeyer was alarmed and pissed off, and he tried to get the administrators to withdraw Churchill's invitation. Okay, and they didn't. And he alerted the student newspaper, and that published a story about Churchill. And was he not allowed to speak there? Was it canceled?
They ended up rescinding the invitation to speak at Hamilton.
Now, the thing that you're seeing in the mainstream press is an excerpt from a broader argument where all you see in the mainstream press, and this is a great example of how irresponsible the mainstream media is for not contextualizing this statement, because whether you agree with the statement or not, that's not the issue. It is the responsibility of the mainstream media not to, you know, kind of fan the fire. In the mainstream media, you're seeing that he compared the victims of the World Trade Center attacks to little Eichmanns, reference to Adolf Eichmann.
Yes.
Now, that's all you really got. In most of the articles I've seen. Am I right, Riley?
No, you're absolutely right.
And what does that imply to me? See, what that implied to me as a liberal person, when I heard about that, I'm like, well, that's a crappy metaphor. I'm not even sure I understand it. I mean, Adolf Eichmann was, you know, one of the architects of the Final Solution that, you know, put, you know, hundreds of thousands of Jews to death at Auschwitz. So how does that make sense? But then when I read the piece that Churchill actually wrote, you know, I will read you the paragraph that it comes from in the essay. It's not an issue of agreeing or disagreeing with the point that Churchill was making. It's about representing what he was saying effectively in the media so people don't start to, you know, crucify this guy. This is how they misrepresent liberals all the time. I mean, you know, they try to make liberals look like whack jobs, look like, you know, anti-American freaks to, you know, and you know, they just found this guy. And let me tell you something. In an article I've got here, I mean, you know, they're trying to get this guy. Let me read the piece first, and then we'll talk about what's happening. This is from Ward Churchill's essay or paper. Some people push back on the justice of roosting chickens. Well, really, let's get a grip here, shall we? True enough, there were civilians of a sort, but innocent, give me a break. And this is in reference to the World Trade Center victims. They formed a technocratic core at the very heart of America's global financial empire, the mighty engine of profit to which the military dimension of U.S. policy has always been enslaved. And they did so both willingly and knowingly. Recourse to ignorance, a derivative, after all, of the word ignore, counts as less than an excuse among this relatively well-educated elite. To the extent that any of them were unaware of the costs and consequences to others of what they were involved in, and in many cases excelling at, it was because of their absolute refusal to see. More likely, it was because they were too busy braying incessantly and self-importantly into their cell phones, arranging power lunches and stock transactions, each of which translated conveniently out of sight, mind, and smelling distance into the starved and rotting flesh of infants. If there was a better, more effective, or in fact any other way of visiting some penalty befitting their participation upon the little Eichmanns inhabiting the sterile sanctuary of the Twin Towers, I'd really be interested in hearing about it. It's fairly complicated, hardcore stuff.
Hey, rough language. It is rough language. But, you know, we do have the ability in this society to use rough language, to take controversial positions.
And also, but to put it into context, you know, Eichmann, it was a weird choice of metaphor. I mean, you know, Nazi metaphors are sort of, you know, hackneyed on the left anyways, but Eichmann does not represent what he's trying to represent here, which I think is more, you know, what Hannah Arendt was trying to discuss in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is the banality of evil, is that the passive participation, the complicity of people that don't know better and don't know that, you know, what they are part of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what he was trying to do. But nobody said that in the mainstream media.
No. And nobody's perfect. I mean, he might have used a different choice of words. We'll get to, however, some things that took place just last night with regard to Ward Churchill after we come back from our break, because there was some really interesting stuff going on out in Colorado.
Yes, sir.
With regard to this man. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 6 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We are hanging out. We are talking about the University of Colorado professor Ward Churchill. We are talking about how the media, the mainstream media, you know, takes things out of context, does not flesh out, you know, what his comments meant. All you got in the mainstream media was that he compared the victims of 9/11 to little Eichmanns. You know, after sort of gleaning a bit from reading the piece that he wrote, so-called Some People Push Back on the Justice of Roosting Chickens, whether you agree with it or not, you know, they did this guy tremendous injustice in the mainstream press. And when he went to Hamilton College, when he was about to go to Hamilton College in upstate New York to give a lecture, not on this piece, one of the professors there did some research on him, found this and made it public and said, look, you know, I don't want this guy to speak at our college because of what was said in this. And in response to that, New York Governor George Pataki called Churchill a bigoted terrorist supporter. Relative of one of the September 11th victims called him a nutcase. And the Colorado legislator branded the comments evil and inflammatory. That was Governor Bill Owens of Chicago called for his ouster. So
Colorado.
In Colorado. Now, what the piece is really about, you know, whether it's misguided or not is really up to you to say. This is not a unique take on the 9/11, you know, coming from the extreme left or even the middle left. The take is essentially that, you know, we had it coming. He argues that, that, you know, this is in response directly to Iraqi sanctions where hundreds of thousands of kids were died for, genocidal negligence and also because of the sanctions we had there. He sort of assumes a kind of a pan-Arabic response in the 9/11, which is not exactly right. But his comparison to the victims in the trade centers as being little Eichmanns was really more of a comparison to Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil, whereas you had the good Germans who did not do anything and stood aside. It is a critique of imperial capitalistic culture is what it is. It's imperialism and capitalism in that these people were unwittingly, you know, complicit in the genocide of the Iraqis and the treatment of Islamic people around the world because of their part in the system.
Number one, War Churchill was not the first, nor was he alone in making this particular analysis, comparing the victims of September 11th to the Iraqi children who died during sanctions, which, by the way, took, you know, were going on for the better part of a decade.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the first.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, number two, you know, you read this piece, it made me profoundly uncomfortable.
Yes.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
There is nothing wrong with a piece making you uncomfortable. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing with what a piece says, either in whole or in part. And I disagree with some of the stuff he says here.
Sure.
But the idea that he is not allowed to speak because someone else, the taxpayers of Colorado or the, you know, the people in Hamilton College who can't, you know, can't at least open their minds enough not to threaten his life.
Yeah, well, he went on stage last night, defended his piece, said, look,
yes,
you know, he wasn't talking about everybody. He was making a specific metaphor, and he didn't say that in a defensive way. He said, I don't have to back down for any of this. And when somebody called him on him being paid by taxpayers' money, he says, I'm not working for Governor Bill Owens. I'm not working for, the government in any way. You know, he's a tenured professor. I'm working for you, the students. And the truth of the matter is, if someone's a tenured professor, not unlike Howard Zinn, not unlike Noam Chomsky, you know, that you have these guys that are in there challenging, Western policy in the world. You know, they are supposed to be there. They have to be there. That's what college is supposed to be about, to embrace a variety of ideas, no matter how, extreme or over the top. These kind of discussions need to take place. They were important to me coming up when I went to BU. Howard Zinn was a professor there. He was a very popular lecturer. All this stuff, I mean, I gravitated towards reactionary writings. It was important in developing my personality. This guy should not be denied his right. And it's not even a First Amendment issue. It's an issue of the state and the college trying to shut him down as a state employee.
He knows, and he mentions that there is an inherent contradiction in the fact that he works for a state-sponsored university but takes this position. He acknowledges that. He says, look, I'm not innocent in all of this. Maybe I'm part of the group of people that are complicit in the deaths of these children as well. But the uncomfortable thing that he is asking Americans to do is to feel other people's pain. And we don't do a good job of that, whether it's Iraqi children or the people in the tsunami. We don't do a great job of feeling other people's pain, and he chose a very uncomfortable means of transmitting that information to us, and there's nothing whatsoever wrong with that.
Right, feeling other people's pain, but also he makes a point about informing yourself, about being aware of, what you're involved in. And he also makes a point about just the nature of dissent in general, that, this is essential to the sort of, rounding out what is supposed to be a democratic culture. It's essential that you have these arguments, that you have these discussions, that you reveal certain truths, and that you provoke. It's essential.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, it's not just, revealing truths. It's also debunking myths. Now, Amiri Baraka, celebrated poet, playwright, et cetera, right here in New York, or actually in New Jersey, did a poem about the Trade Center that implied that Jews knew something in advance about the attacks on the World Trade Center. Now, I happen to believe he was wrong in doing it, but this was during the course of a poem, and it created that same kind of uproar of people, he's being insensitive, he's being divisive, et cetera, et cetera. The Baraka was the poet laureate of the state of New Jersey, and eventually ended up giving up that particular. He either gave it up or it ran out. His tenure ran out. But the bottom line here is that people, the same people who will argue against political correctness when it takes the form of teaching anti-racism in a Massachusetts high school, as one example, will stand up and talk about this guy like he needs to be censored. And it is amazing to me that people who say that one form of speech is political correctness or embodies political correctness will not tolerate some incorrectness from someone who they disagree with ideologically.
Right. This is the dominant semantic paradigm of this culture.
Yes.
You know, coming down on somebody that disagrees with them. I mean, to the point where, you know, it seems suspect to me that they use this guy to sort of, you know, try to crucify a liberal. You know, that you get somebody with an extreme view like this. You get somebody who's got long hair. You get somebody who's, you know, outspoken and not willing to back down. And you make an example of this person. But you know what? It's not going to work. You know, this guy is going to go on teaching. This guy has a right to go on teaching. And David Horowitz, of all people.
Of all people.
Who was, you know, of course, the...
radical turned conservative turned wacko.
Yeah. He says that if firing Churchill would violate his First Amendment rights and set a bad precedent. This isn't like a guy who was suddenly exposed, Horowitz said. This is a guy who's been out there, you know, openly for 30 years and was promoted. I mean, these guys have a real problem with what's left of the liberals who were tenured, you know, before, you know, during, after the 60s, shortly after the 60s, and when colleges do that. So that's sort of the next wave of these think tank idiots. But they're not idiots. That's the wrong word. These strategists are now going to try and lock liberals out of academic institutions, which will be a disaster.
And they're also going to try and chip away at tenure for people whose views they disagree
with. That could happen if this is brought to court, I imagine.
Absolutely it could. Well, absolutely it could.
That's a disaster.
And, you know, for the Regents of the University of Colorado to apologize to all Americans for something this guy said is just, to me, one of the most gutless, cowardly things that a group of people can do.
Absolutely.
You know, you tenured the guy, okay? It's not like we didn't do this in studio. The guy's been tenured for a good long time. He was going to speak to Hamilton College, by the way, about American Indian activism. He's very close to Russell Means and the whole American Indian movement people. And see, at a point, there needs to be, and I think this is the important thing that the people at the University of Colorado who came out last night, many of whom supported him.
A thousand people stood up.
Yeah, they stood up for him because they knew, whether they agreed with him or not, it was important to have the discourse, important to have the dialogue, and for no other reason than to tell people 500,000 Iraqi kids died during the embargo.
Just to give them some new information, to see some of the faces in that room, to see how CNN shot it, too. They were very careful to make sure that, you know, every cut was to, you know, somebody.
Security guy.
But also someone with long hair, someone with a piercing, somebody. And then, like, there was a couple of cuts of the back of the room, which were just the guys with the KKK faces and the folded arms.
Yeah.
The hate.
We'll get them.
And we'll be back at 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Check out all our favorite links, our latest blog entries, and our new line of merchandise at morningsedition.com.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We were talking about Ward Churchill, and last night he made his stand. He defended his right to say what he wants to say, and it was well received by thousands of people. Not thousands. It was about 1,000 people standing up there. Hundreds.
No, I was going to say 1,000. There were 1,000 in there, from what I saw.
There was a few haters, but, you know, this is an amazing thing because, you know, people need, especially in academia, this is essential to have this dialogue. If these guys didn't exist, if, you know, what is left of the sort of, you know, liberal, leftist idea, not leftist, I mean, that seems like a dated word, but if you didn't have these tenured professors who have been there for 30 years who still have the freedom to talk about this stuff, like Howard Zinn, like Noam Chomsky, you know, it would retard this culture even more. And as you were saying, Mark Riley, that this could be, you know, if they do take this to court, that they could conditionalize tenure.
I think that that's what their end game is, that they realize, and it kind of came forward in the quote that you read from David Horowitz, arch conservative, who said, well, we're trying to figure out why the guy got tenure in the first place. That's what they're reaching for. They want to do two things. One, stop people who are progressives from getting tenure and find a way to get rid of tenured people whose opinions and attitudes they disagree with. But the problem is, this is the definition of freedom. This is what we're talking. You know, they talk about Operation Iraqi Freedom and this kind of freedom and sending troops here and there and all over the place. The bottom line is, if we have any pretense to tell any other government or any other people how they should conduct their lives, then everybody should be backing Ward Churchill's right to think and write and speak precisely what's on his mind.
And also, you know, one of the other things that should upset you to no end is the way this guy was characterized in the mainstream press. Just see, you know, there is no liberal press. There is a conservative press, and there is an irresponsible press. I mean, this guy was taken out of context, was allowed to be made to look like a fool, some sort of, you know, liberal whack job, because they did not paraphrase him properly. They did not explore the piece that he wrote, where the comments came from. I bet you most of the people that wrote these pieces that I'm looking at from Associated Press, from Reuters, wherever, did not even read this, did not even read the paper that he wrote in order to put his comments into context. And that's heinous. That's just as heinous, you know, not quite as heinous as Colorado Governor Bill Owens, you know, calling for this guy's firing, this guy's removal. The guy stepped down as chair of the ethics department at the school, but remains a professor and will stay there. We're going to talk.
It's ethnic, by the way.
Ethnic. What did I say? Ethic. I'm sorry.
No, there's nothing to be sorry about.
Makes a big difference, a letter. Ethnic, ethic.
This is part and parcel. See, because politicians make hay off this sort of thing.
Huh?
Politicians love this sort of thing. It gives them a chance to stand up and burnish their, you know, conservative credentials, but whether it's George Pataki or Bill Owens.
Right, but this really needs to, these guys need to be protected, because, you know, if we deny the kids, I just talked to a kid from Dartmouth who was interviewing me, you know, and what goes on, he was talking, you know, he's interviewing me about what we do here and everything else, and then he said, what do I feel about Social Security? And I'm like, well, what do you feel? He says, well, I think, you know, the system's in trouble. I said, where do you get that information? He said, well, we had a guy speak up here. Our school brought an ex-Bushy up there to speak, and I'm like, well, there's your story. What the hell is that guy doing up there selling you guys on the new Social Security plan? Why don't you ask your school that question? All right, we're going to take a call. Damien is on the phone. How are you, Damien? What's up?
Good morning, hey, Damien.
Good morning.
What's on your mind, man?
Actually, I just have a real quick story. I went to grew up in Oceanside, California. Uh-huh. You know, you have the Marine Corps base out there. You have a lot of the Kill Hussein signs as a kid. I ended up going into the military, infantry. I got sent to New York. I did my time. I ended up getting out, and I ended up going to school. Well, they recommended the Howard Zinn book.
People's History of the United States?
People's History, yes. And I now understand exactly what happened in the past now with our military explorations, if you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
All the way from Columbus.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is I went into the military, but I must say there is a movement, especially out in California, going on where people are very conscious of this. And a lot of my friends actually became what I'd say Rastafarians. You know, there's a big underground hip hop movement.
Mm-hmm.
Very conscious.
Within the military?
I met a lot of people in the military who were conscious, and they were saying, you know, I'm doing my time and get out of here. But there's not a whole lot as much as I would like to be in the military.
You're talking more about school, huh?
But you're just saying that you've you had a change of heart and mind when you were educated with the truth.
Oh, yes.
Well, thanks for calling us. Thanks a lot, Damien.
Thanks, Damien.
Well, that's interesting, is that you forget that history, you know, what's that old saying, is from the eyes of the victorious or the victors, or,
yeah.
You know, that, you know, Zinn's book is a powerful book because it's from a completely different point of view. It's from the point of view of the victims of American policy and imperialism. And it is a mind blower.
Yeah. As are a lot of these works.
And that's what Churchill is talking about.
Yeah, and you know, look, you can quibble with some of the things that he wrote. You can say that he should have been a little bit more precise. He shouldn't have used the Eichmann reference. You know, there are other things in the body of the work, if you read the work, that you might want to argue with.
Yeah.
But that's not a problem. War, Churchill, and I could go to Lord knows, not a Starbucks necessarily. We'd go to a coffee shop and sit and argue for hours.
Sure. You know, and the other interesting thing that guy was saying is I've gotten a little flack a couple of times in you know, what they think is that I mischaracterize the military sometimes is that there are a lot of good cats in the military.
Oh, no
doubt. There are people that are in the military because they honestly want to help the world. You know, and I forget that sometimes. I think liberals forget that too. That these are not, you know. Oh, it came around that guy Mattis, the guy.
Yeah.
You know, when we were talking about just how heinous that guy's language was, and saying that he liked to shoot people, he was, you know, sociopathic. You know, to some people are like, you know, some of us, you know, do want to help.
Yes, we do want to help.
And we,
yeah.
866-303-2270 for your dreams. I'm going to read my dream when we come back. We want to hear your dreams and take a crack at them. 866-303-2270.
This is Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition.
Right now,
call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron. Here's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I got my orange juice. I got my tea and lemon. Got my zinc and echinacea. I'm all set.
Whoa.
I'm strapped in. I'm ready for dreams. I want to hear people's dreams. 866-303-2270. Here's my dream from last night. I'm lying on my couch trying to finish David Thompson's book when the doorbell rings. When I answer it, these four huge guys in black suits and red burning eyes barge into my house. They push me back on the couch, and one of them punches me in the gut and says, "We're going to need these." And he takes my glasses. Gasping, I say... I say, "Hey, a-hole, those are mine, man." He says, "Sorry, budget cuts, got to bring down the deficit." So I'm squinting, and I'm bumping into things, and one other guy takes out a steak knife and cuts out my kidney. I'm like, "What the? Ow, jeez!" He says, "Sorry, budget cuts, got to pay for the Iraq War." Through the blood and pain, I manage to say, "Hey, give me back my kidney, man." He tosses my wet, bloody kidney into a Tupperware dish and says, "One should be enough." Then another guy takes a pair of pliers and rips off my ears. I'm like, "What the? Ow, man!" He says, "Sorry, budget cuts, got to pay for the inauguration." Even in complete agony, I say, "What? What? I didn't vote for him." Before I could say anything else, another guy pulls the cord on a chainsaw and hacks off both my legs. He says, "Sorry, budget cuts, got to pay for the president's abstinence program." Despite the loss of blood, I crawl into the bathroom and manage to reach a bottle of Vicodin for the pain. Just as I take it, one of the goons pulls the pill out of my mouth. He says, "Sorry, budget cuts, got to pay for Laura Bush's anti-gang program." I'm lying helpless on the floor, and just before I black out, I say, How am I supposed to survive after all these cuts?" One of them just says, "Have you tried praying?" But just as I was about to pray, they took my tongue. I woke up, and my bed was filled with half of what it used to be filled with. Now it's your turn. Give us a call, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Ellen in Manhattan, would you like to share your dream with us, Ellen?
Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Well, after I realized that it was 3 hours of watching the same, no, three different Wiggles VCR or VHS discs with my 2-year-old grandson.
Yeah.
So that might have had something to do with the dream.
Okay.
Because I was telling the screener that they were like boxed huge rooms with kitchens. And one was lavender and white and belonged to a friend I haven't seen in years.
These are square rooms, like boxes?
But they were huge.
Okay. Okay.
And hers, she was very bourgeois and always had money and everything.
Ah.
Money. So hers was all very tidy and neat. And she said, "Yes, isn't this the best one of all?"
Yeah.
I said, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." But there was one that I think might have belonged to Clifford, the big red dog.
Yeah.
And some woman also that was living with Clifford, not the little Mary, Emily Elizabeth or whatever her name is.
Sure.
But it was like a full-grown woman. And then my home was like a huge spiral red metal staircase, the type that goes up to a water tower.
Okay.
And there was, it was just the cylindrical staircase kept going up and up, and I thought, when I woke up, what a funny place for home, because there was no roof and there was no floor.
Yeah.
Just a cylinder.
Well, you know what?
Whatever.
I'll tell you.
Whatever. That's deep.
Ellen, it's a pretty deep dream. You know, because, you know, if I can read it properly, when you see a square or a square room that's in, yeah, that is compact and contains things that you can easily identify with, that assumes a certain sort of order, that there's a certain semblance of stability to a square, you know, and that all these things that you saw, like your friend, as you said, was, you know, rich and always well-to-do,
yeah,
that maybe you saw her as more stable than you because of that that economic security.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then you go into the next room, which is Clifford and the kid, and, you know, that I think that represents the stability of your grandkids and your own family.
Maybe.
And then, like, I think the staircase traditionally symbolizes change or transformation. And the idea of a tower is very interesting because when you live in a tower, you're sort of looking down on everyone else. There's a certain element of superiority. So maybe you're rising to some point where you really see things clearly, except that there is no floor. Isn't that what he said?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and no ceiling either, so there was no topping this.
So that's interesting. So maybe your feeling of superiority, you know, is not as grounded in the reality as you think, but you're afraid of transformation and you're seeing, you know, all these other people as having more stability than you. It sounds like you're going through some changes. It might be a good thing.
Oh, I am. Oh. Mark, I wrote you a scathing email yesterday because I don't like some of your sponsors, but today your show was so good.
Well, thank you, Ellen.
And I have to tell you that tenure is such a problem amongst any of my friends, a lot of them, because we're all writers,
uh-huh,
that are in colleges in New York City.
Uh-huh.
My publisher hasn't gotten tenure. She's been there for 35, 40 years.
So they're stopping it, huh?
She's an old leftist. She's from Berkeley. You know, very left. Her biography is coming out now, her autobiography, I should say.
Okay.
And all they do is take her days away. They give her less and less time, so she can't even retire.
Okay. Well, you know, we'll get into that another time, Ellen. Thank you for calling us.
Yes, thank you, Ellen. That's deep, though.
Yeah,
that was a deep analysis you did. The only thing I can think of, you ever see the movie White Heat?
Yeah.
When Cagney goes all the way up to the
top of that tower
and screams,
yeah,
top of the world, Ma. When she was describing her dream, that was the first image that came to my mind.
Trippy, man.
Yeah.
I love these because that was a real dream. Steve, listening in Connecticut. How are you, Steve?
Hey, Steve.
Good. How are you?
Good, man.
Okay, here's the dream.
Okay.
I'm walking up and down the aisles of a library.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, I see someone tied to a chair.
Okay.
I go to see the person, and it's Henry Winkler in a suit. But it looks a lot like John Kerry, so I'm picturing it as, like, just John Kerry. and so I go to free him, and all of a sudden, George W. Bush appears in his blue suit. He pulls out from behind his back this giant orange monkey wrench, and he's about to hit this Henry Winkler person.
And, wow.
And so he goes to hit him, and he just taps him in the leg, and Henry Winkler says, "That's it? That didn't hurt at all."
You mean he didn't go, "Ay"?
Well, no, he didn't go, "Ay," and I was disappointed. But, what did I do? I couldn't take it back at that point.
Hey, Steve, did you watch the Happy Days reunion the other night?
No, I didn't at all. This is the first, I didn't even know it was on.
Wow.
I saw a commercial for it, and when I'm listening to your dream, I wondered if you maybe saw the commercial, and it stuck in your mind, and that's why Henry Winkler came up in your dream.
Now,
I have no idea where Henry Winkler came from, but what happened is so Henry Winkler's like, "Okay, that didn't hurt at all," and George W. Bush is like, "Well, I just had to do it, you know, they told me to do it, it's nothing personal," and the Henry Winkler character is like, "Oh, okay," and the George W. Bush leaves, and I say, "Aren't you going to go after him? He just hit you with a monkey wrench." He's like, "No, he said it wasn't personal, and it was something that he had to do, and it didn't hurt, and he..." So, well, big deal. Let bygones be bygones. And I actually agreed with that.
Wow, that's the weirdest dream. That's one of the weirder ones I've heard.
It is.
Now, how old are you?
I'm 28.
Okay, so you're not my age, because, you know, I remember when I was, like, a kid, Henry Winkler was actually cool, unfortunately. That, you know, when I was, like, 12 or whenever the hell Happy Days was on, there was an element of a coolness, but he doesn't have that same representation to you. I mean, a library, I think, is clearly a search for knowledge and wisdom, and you're in this library, and you see this sort of, you know, icon from 70s television that is actually representing an icon from the 50s. You know, he's strapped to a chair and he represents John Kerry on some level. Well, you know, it might have something to do with Kerry sort of like, you know, being a wuss after the election and not really standing up for himself.
There you
and
go
yet,
with
you're
that.
You're sitting there looking at Fonzie thinking like, you're the Fonz, dude. You know, don't take that. And he was just like, no, it's okay. You know, I get it. You know, whatever. It seems like the Kerry thing was that you had expectations out of Fonzie because he's Fonzie to stand up for himself and he didn't. And because you're obviously a liberal or a Democrat, you know, you kind of like said, well, I guess it's okay if John Kerry Fonzie says it's okay. But you woke up a little disappointed, huh?
Yeah, definitely disappointed. I was like, why didn't you go after him? Fine, don't let him get away with this.
Exactly. I think that's like, it's like, you know, you had expectations out of the Fonz and he let you down.
Got it. This is bothering more than I thought, isn't it? This election loss.
Oh. Yeah. It gets deep, man. Thanks a lot for your call.
And this is free announcement.
I
just want our listeners to know this is free. Only costs you, and it doesn't even cause a toll free call.
You know, it's weird because like I kind of get into this, and I realize I don't really have any credibility when it comes to this. But when I'm sitting there going, no, what that's about? It's that easy. I got a new career ahead.
Hey,
you know what I mean?
You can do that after this.
Yeah, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to be a dream guy. All right, hey, what do we got? We got Jim listening in Illinois. How are you, Jim?
Hey, Jim.
Okay, I had a dream just last night, and I dreamed I was in a mental institution, and there was a guy making a knife out of some razor blades and a stick, and he was just laughing and laughing. He was having a good old time. So I said, you shouldn't have that thing. So I reached to take it away from him, and he slashed my wrist. Then I went and told the staff, and the staff put me in restraints for trying to commit suicide. They said that I tried to commit suicide, and they put me in restraints.
Wow. Where are you calling from?
Well, I'm calling from Illinois. I'm calling from my home.
Okay.
Not Joliet.
Well, you know what? We're gonna crunch that analysis. Stay on the phone. We'll talk to you after the break about your mental institution dream. I'll take a crack at it, Jim. It's 44 past the hour. We'll come back with Jim's analysis after this. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Join the morning tradition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning tradition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Morning Tradition on Air America Radio. We're taking dreams. We're analyzing dreams. It's fun. 866-303-2270. It's okay if we have some fun, isn't it?
No.
Though Jim's dream was a little heavy. Hey, Jim. You there? Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I'm
here. Hey, buddy. So you're in a mental institution. A guy is making a knife out of razor blades. He cuts your wrist, and the staff puts you in restraints for that guy making it look like you commit suicide. Now, From what I understand, if you're dreaming about a mental institution, you need to take a break, buddy. You're stressed out. You know, I mean, you need to rest. You know what I mean? Your brain is looking for some relief. And, you know, being put into restraints or being in restraints, you know, sort of connotes or implies that, you know, you're holding back from something. And the suicide is obviously suicide. Suicide is a, you know, the weird thing about this is that it's some other guy doing it. So you're sort of being set up. You're being set up in this dream. Somebody is trying to kill you and blames it on you.
Yeah.
So I think that you feel a certain amount of injustice. Someone's causing you some sort of pain or injustice in your life. Is that possible outside of the president?
Well, I'd have to say the whole climate in this country right now, I don't know. It just seems as if...
Yeah.
The whole political climate is kind of screwing around.
Sure. I mean, that makes perfect sense, man. You need a break from it, and you feel like, you know, somebody is you know, putting the restraints on you and you know, acting like it's your fault for being for being crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're perfectly justified in feeling crazy. It's a crazy time. Thanks for calling, Jim.
Thanks,
okay,
sir.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was wild. I'm like, you know, I'm like, I just feel myself like I'm going into the head now. You know what I mean? Like, you know, here I go. Okay, let's talk to Tom. Tom, how are you? What's your dream, Tom, in Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah, this one isn't quite as heavy as the other guy, but I woke up this morning from this. It was kind of weird. My dream was about having a date with actress Juliana Margulies.
Nice.
Yeah, she was gorgeous.
She's one from ER?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was wearing a full-length, kind of Asian-style silk dress and
yeah.
Her hair pulled back and... I don't know why we were driving around in it, but I think we were either in a Hummer or a monster truck, something, you know, huge.
Right.
And I was trying to impress her, I think, with my, you know, inside knowledge of Hollywood, which I really have, but, you know, I was trying to fake it. And
dropping people's names and whatnot.
Yeah, and I'm telling her how cool I thought Team America World Police was, and that, you know, Matt and Trey were just, you know, so visionary and you know, spoofing the right and the left.
I know this, yeah.
And so, you know, I'm telling her things like, well, you know, their guiding principle while they made the movie was, you know, WWJBD, what would Jerry Bruckheimer do? And, you know, she just wasn't impressed with that. I could just tell she was just kind of like turning cold to me and, you know, I tried to hug her and it just, nothing was working. So I woke up and, you know, my bed was filled with indifference.
Oh. See what happens when you bring Stone and Parker up to some women. They're just sort of like, I don't get that.
Yeah.
You know, it happens with South Park, too. But you had everything going. It's interesting, though. It almost seemed like we were heading into some sort of, like, vaguely Republican fantasy with the Hummer and everything else. Was that all a big sham? I mean, clearly you were making a big affront to her by, you know, dropping, I'm sure you're sort of dropping Tom Selleck's name and maybe Don Knotts and trying to show prove yourself to be some sort of Hollywood insider. So you're sort of scamming her. And the one thing that it sounds that was honest in this whole thing was that, you know, you really liked the comedy of Trey Parker and Matt Stone and that, you know, she didn't get that. So the one point of honesty, you know, she was just like, nah. You had her going, right? I mean, that kind of outside of the lies, but you had everything going on and you just, this is an impotent dream. You failed, didn't you?
That hurts.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that was the intent in the first place.
You tried, Tom. You tried. You did everything you could, but the second you're on, she didn't like you for you. So you're gonna have to go back into your dream and just, you know, maybe just show her more of yourself and see what happens.
Yeah.
Either that or next time dream about Janine Garofalo. I don't know. You know?
Well, you go ahead and knock yourself out, buddy. All right, take it easy. Take it easy, Tom.
Oh, wow. Now you're going to start a feud with the other host of the Majority Report, right?
No, I love Janine.
I know.
I mean, I think she's very cute. You know, it's just weird. I've known her for years, but I never had those kind of thoughts about her. It's just a weird thing. She's just my friend. You know what I mean? Carlos, listening to WLIB in New York. How are you?
Hey, Carlos.
What's your dream? What's your dream?
Man, I'm having a tough one shaking this one off.
Yeah?
Ooh. Yeah. It's okay. 1967. I'm in the jungle. I'm wearing fatigues. I'm holding an M16 in my hand.
Okay.
Walking along the path, and all of a sudden, I come across Vince Neil.
Okay, from Motley Crue?
From Motley Crue. Yeah, okay. This isn't Vince Neil recently, you know, who's getting the plastic surgery. This is like 1981 Vince Neil.
Primetime Vince Neil.
Primetime Vince Neil, and he's wearing a bunny suit.
Okay.
So yeah. I go up to him and he tells me I have a mission, that me and him have to go find the Holy Grail.
Okay.
All right, so we're walking along, and all of a sudden, swoops down out of the sky. You guys remember this movie, The Never Ending Story?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That dragon thing, that white thing with wings that flew?
Yeah.
Stops down. He's like, all right, I'll take you guys to the Holy Grail.
Falcor.
There you go, Falcor.
Yeah.
So we have fun, right? We're flying through the sky, flying through the sky. All of a sudden, we get to a cave.
Okay.
Falcor turns.
Falcor.
Because there's a witch.
Are you breaking up a little bit? Falcor, you go to a cave, you go in there, and there's a witch in there?
He says, watch out for the witch.
Okay.
I walk in.
Yeah.
And there's, in the cave, there's a bed made of skulls.
Okay.
And I'm lying on top of the bed, Ann Coulter, in a dominatrix outfit.
Yay!
So I look at Vince, and Vince looks at me, and he goes, you got to take one for the team, bro.
I, you know, Are you sure you weren't just recently in Hollywood?
No, I wasn't.
How'd you wake up after that one, Carlos?
I woke up in a cold sweat, and the bed smelled like Paul Wolfowitz.
I can't even begin to analyze that. It seems that your rock and roll hero. You know what? I think that what you were doing there is fighting the right the only way you knew how.
There you go.
All right.
And I think that you know that the Holy Grail that you know you were. Oh wow! There's so much there. There's so much there, Carlos. You've got Vince Neil at the peak of his form. You're originally fighting. You know, he was in a bunny suit, which means. Oh my God! You know, I'm gonna have to like work on that and post it on the blog or something. My God, that one's not as easy.
Many layers to that one.
Yeah, I'll try and come up with something over the top of the hour in a second. let me just parse it out a little bit. I need a little time on that. Wow, that was big.
That was.
What time is it now? We can take it. Yeah. Okay.
In the next hour we're gonna tackle a subject that has. Been going back and forth in the black community for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is black men who are straight, supposedly, but also sleep with men.
Mm-hmm.
And how prevalent are they and how important are they in spreading the AIDS virus? Because
wow.
That's a subject of a great deal of contention, as is the whole issue of black homosexuality. We'll get into that and a whole heck of a lot more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning's Sedition with Mark Maron, who is me, and Mark Riley, who is him.
Hi!
That's right. The facts, the fury, the funny Morning's Sedition.
Don't be stupid!
Ah, we did some pictures the other day, buddy.
Yeah.
I looked at him briefly.
Yeah?
Mark Riley and I did a big photo shoot right over there in that room.
That's right. For Bronze Thrills magazine.
It looked good, man. It looked good.
Did it look good?
Yeah, it looked good. You know what? I don't think that my choice to have a haircut the day before I do photos was a great idea. Why are you shaking your head, Kayla? Am I a vain, weird, self-centered man? Is that what's going on?
You know that
Am
already.
I know that. Okay, fine. All right, but you're going to tell me that I'm the only guy that says, you know, damn, my hair's not right. Yeah, I'm the only guy.
But hey, look, I didn't shave. I didn't get when I got home. My wife's yelling at me. You took a photo shoot. You didn't shave. I don't care.
You don't really. No. What's wrong with me? You know, Stacy upstairs, who works upstairs, says that she's never heard a man complain about his hair so much. And then she goes on to tell me that she watches her man play with his dreadlocks for literally hours.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, but you know, come on. I mean, you're telling me that, all right, I'm not going to get into this. You know, it was only because.
I wish I could grow dreadlocks.
It was only because. You could. You just, you know,
no,
you,
I can't. Don't, I'd have to have Extension City up in here.
You got to be seriously self-obsessed to have dreadlocks. I mean, it takes a lot of work. What are you kidding me? You guys spend hours on those things.
No, you don't.
Please.
You just put a hat on. Where's our man, the engineering guy, Gerald? Gerald's got dreadlocks. You wouldn't know it, though, because he always wears a hat.
But really, it doesn't take effort? I thought those guys sat around.
Well, yeah,
and,
you
like,
have to, yeah.
Don't you have to use, like, you know, goop and, you know, stuff? And
no, you
things?
Put some oil in it, make sure it's, you know, kept fresh. You got to keep them clean. But right. Other than that, I mean, it's not the highest maintenance. It's not as high maintenance being bald, perhaps.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm gonna get started on some dreads.
You going to do some dreads?
I'm going to get some Jewish dreadlocks, buddy.
Ah.
So I'm doing Jerusalem Syndrome on Saturday. I got to get some rest.
In San Diego, right?
San Diego at the Poway Center for Performing Arts near San Diego. It's it's February 12th. I'm not sure what time it starts, but you can get tickets at morningsedition.com in the tour date section. I'll also be at Symphony Space next week. I'm going to get some people tickets. We're going to give away some tickets next week to Symphony Space.
I heard about Symphony Space. You want me to tell you how I heard
tickets
about it?
Tickets going fast. Yeah. What was that about? Tell me about it.
Our good friend and, I believe, outgoing CEO, Doug Krieger.
Doug Krieger, the guy whose son made that cup that I drink out
of
all the
lovely
time.
Cup.
Yeah.
Doug Krieger leaves a message on my cell phone yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Says, oh, you know, I haven't talked to you in a while. I've been out of town.
Yeah.
And I saw your picture at Symphony Space. Oh. Getting ready to perform there.
Yeah.
So I call him back and said, Doug, that's the white guy. That's Maverick.
What did he say? He goes,
he said, oh.
I don't know. You know, I don't work there anymore.
But he loves the show.
Yeah. Oh, no, he does. I hear they listen to it all the time.
Yeah.
How are you, Krieger? We miss having you in here to, you know, kind of put you on the grill there. You know what
he
I mean?
He was out in Hawaii.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
God, life's rough when you're rich. You know what I mean? It's like... It's very difficult to, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you can't take the Greyhound to Hawaii, you know what I'm saying?
You ever been to Hawaii?
No.
Kauai. I went to Kauai. Unbelievable.
All my West Coast relatives do Hawaii. I mean, that to them, that's like going to the Caribbean for people here.
I went there I went there years ago with my first wife, and we took one of them helicopter rides.
Oh, yeah?
The kind that crash.
Ooh.
I did, it's one of those things, though, because I'm not as afraid of flying as I used to be, but I'm like, you know what? Let's just do this. What are the odds? And you fly right up along the Nepali coast. Mind-blowing, dude. Mind-blowing. The thing that's amazing about Kauai, it's got every type of terrain. It's got rainforests. It's got sand dunes. It's got... the rugged sort of cliff terrain. I saw whales.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
The place is unbelievable. It's a little weird. The fish are a little spoiled. You know,
they won't come out of the water and sit on the frying pan for you?
Well, no, on the south, I think it's the south side at Poipu Beach. Like, everyone goes in with snorkeling equipment and they bring food. You know, like to make the fish out of their eat out of their hands.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So these fish, you're underwater, and these fish are like, yeah, what do you got? And we're hanging out. Yeah, they say, look at us. Hey, look pretty, right? What do you got? You got anything for me?
Yeah, I had that yesterday, man. Come back with something.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, bring some. Yeah, I get home yesterday. One of my mongooses. I don't know which one. There's nothing worse than coming home. You know, we work hard, boy, and we work in the middle of the night. And I was tired yesterday. I felt like I was getting sick, and I had to run my show. And, you know, I get home, and one of the geniuses, one of the animals, like right in the middle of my bathroom mat, Riley, right in the middle. Hello, good morning. Here's a little present for you. How about some cat poop? Good morning.
Oh.
How are you? Right in the middle of my bathroom mat. And what are you going to do?
Which one was guilty?
I don't know, dude. They're just dumb cats.
Well, you got to look in their eyes. One of them will tell you with their eyes. I did it.
I believe that to be true. Because I started looking at my... Because you start doing that because I'm pathetic and lonely and my wife lives in California. That I'm sitting there going, okay, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Who is, like, was it you?
Yeah.
And then you start reading in their faces, like, maybe. Maybe it was. Maybe you deserved it. I think cats do that. Well, at least, like, can we be crass? Can we be... What kind of moron is this guy?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, a Welsh rugby fan. I'm sorry. We're going to get a little dirty, all right? But we've done it before. But what kind of moron... A Welsh rugby fan cut off his own testicles to celebrate Wales beating England at rugby. Cut off his... Dude, this guy said, he basically said that if they win, I'm going to cut off my own nads. All right? And they won, and he's at the bar, and he goes outside, cuts
snip,
off...
Snip, snip.
And he comes back in, he goes, I did it. At what point do you go... Dude, you need to be in the hospital. A moron?
Hey, they're playing soccer today. What's next?
Well, thank God he's not going to have any kids.
Yeah, really.
You know what I mean? That's it. That
no evil
that.
Rugby spawn.
Obviously it's a select case. I just don't understand that kind of behavior.
Well, you know, medical research could maybe reattach him or
it's awful.
Create artificial ones.
It's awful, right?
No, I don't even know why. There is no replacing those.
I didn't know why we're talking about it.
That's exactly what it was. But at least he bent over and picked him up, right?
Yeah. Oh, awful. What have we done?
But wait a minute. You know,
our snipper's going to walk in here any minute now.
Where?
Uh-oh. It changed. The show has changed. I don't know.
One hour we're doing cloning. Now we're doing this. That's okay, though. You know, we're versatile.
We definitely are versatile, and we got a big hour coming up. We got this writer, his name is Keith Boykin, to talk about the down low.
Yeah.
About the world of gay black men who are married and the implications of that.
Well, yeah, and the mythology and urban legend that has seemed to grow around the discovery, like it happened yesterday,
stuff's
of this whole down low phenomenon.
But the down low is just it's a title that's been given to something that's really, you know, been in existence since the beginning of gayness, I imagine.
Well, I mean, look, you know, the down low.
Let me
low,
check my gayness history.
Yes, go into gayness history, and then click on the black icon.
Black icon, and then subtext down low.
Down low. I mean, down low, first of all, was an expression to describe anything that was done undercover.
Right.
It had no sexual connotation necessarily.
Right,
you know,
right,
you were,
right. Keep it quiet.
Yeah, keep
right.
it quiet. Yeah. I don't want everybody to know exactly what
right.
I'm doing. I don't
right.
want everybody to know my business.
Right.
You know, like Marin, for example, is counting $100 bills right now.
Yeah, I wish.
If he was doing it behind my back, he'd be on the down low.
These are singles.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've got this, like, I just reached in my pocket and I had all this money, and this is a little OCD thing I do. If they're not all in the same order, I go crazy. Now they're all in the same order. Look, they're all, see that?
Money, 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 money.
All right, we're digressing.
Yeah.
We got Bush and Social Security. We have Bush, you know, taking a shot at a woman who holds three jobs and has a mentally challenged kid. Taking a just like, you know, pow! 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there.
Good morning.
It's morning's edition on Air America Radio. Wow. Hey, we're looking for a spy, okay? You hear me out here. If you've got a kid who's going to be learning intelligent design in school, we want your help exposing what goes on in that classroom. So email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. We've gotten a lot of emails around this, and we're still looking. We want to wire a kid. We want to wire the kid and listen to him be taught about intelligent design. It's now time, it's that time of the morning where we look at the nation's most prestigious newspapers. Now, sometimes when you read the headlines, it's tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is trying to say. You know, so I've got a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi Headliner Translator. How do you like that? Headline Translator. This thing is expensive. All right, let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From the New York Times, new White House estimate lifts drug benefit costs to $720 billion. Let's stick that in the machine. There we go. Look at that. Oh. Here's the translation. Cost of buying senior citizens' vote in 2004 election higher than expected. Yes. Yes, from Fox News. Rice urges Europe to look to future. Throw that in there. Look at it thinking. Translation. Rice urges Europe to embrace amnesia. Amnesia. Hello, is this on? Here we go. From the Associated Press, Sarah Jessica Parker to launch fragrance. And something smells funny in here. Here we go. Unemployed actress seeks alternate revenue streams. Sorry. Hold on, let me make a funny noise here. Unemployed actress seeks alternate revenue streams. Funny the second time. Tremendous.
I love that new sound.
Tremendous. It's a great sound. Now, can we play this sound first? Now, Bush is out there peddling his Social Security, huckstering it up.
Snake oil.
He's out there in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yep.
All right. This is February 8th. This is last Friday. We get some sound. Today is the Friday. Today is the 8th, right? Let me look at my watch.
Today's the 9th.
Man, I'm lost. I'm lost in a wilderness where I don't know what to do. This comes from last Friday, which was the 4th, February 4th, in Nebraska. He's talking, and there's a little impromptu riffage with a woman who was there in the audience, a Mary Mornin. This is classic Bush.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs, and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
Thank you.
Get any sleep?
Not much.
Mm-hmm.
Not much.
Hopefully this will help you get your sleep to know that when we talk about Social Security, nothing changes.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
Oh.
Yeah, man.
And he's trying to sell his plan.
Boy, she caught him off guard. Uniquely American. How about that, folks?
Yeah.
You know, the wealthiest country in the world. She's got to work three jobs, has three kids, one of them mentally challenged. Terrific. Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for being a part of it. Let's can we hear one more time? it's just baffling because there's a moment there, Chris, Caleb, where, you know, you just hear it in his voice where it's like, oh, I've got, wow, uniquely American. That's what he comes up. Yeah, it's a bad thing. All right, let's hear it.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
Thank you.
Get any sleep?
Not much.
Mm-hmm.
Not much.
Well, hopefully this will help you get your sleep to know that when we talk about Social Security, nothing changes.
Okay.
Yes, right.
Thank you.
And he's laughing. What is that? What is that? Uniquely American. And who was clapping, Riley? Yes, it is. What does that mean?
That was just a bizarro moment. They figured, well, you know, aren't you, Bush is saying to the woman, aren't you wonderful? Without ever asking himself, like, you know, first of all, since he's really only worked a couple jobs before he became president, you know, what must it be like for an American woman, single mom, to work three jobs? This never crossed his mind.
Never he really just, had to work, though.
No, he never had to work. And you know, to him, working three jobs is uniquely American, and, you know, you can sleep better at night. How do you know you can sleep better at night? You got to wake up in the middle of the night to go to your other job.
I know. He did another good one, Chris. This is another one. This is different, though. This is not Funny Man Bush. This is where Bush, his salesman tactics really, really come into question here. Can we hear that second one now, Chris?
Being that I am currently a student, I'm a doctoral student, and using my tuition money in order to help support my sister, this is bankrupting me. So it's very, very important that we fix this issue so that other people do not go through
it. What she's saying is a really interesting point, isn't it? Mom dies at what age?
She died at 67.
67, so she really didn't lived long enough to take advantage of the money she had put in the system, and yet, because of survivors, and there are survivor benefits, but there's an age limit on survivor benefits, the survivors receive nothing.
So there you go. He's using her dead mother to sell his plan. Hey, I'm sorry to hear about your mom, but it illustrates my point.
You know, it's amazing to me that this woman's situation, I don't think, would have changed one bit by privatization. I don't see how you can make the connection that his plan would have created any difference in her specific situation. She's saying she has to use tuition money to take care of her ill sister. So what's going to change about what? They figure her private Social Security money would pay for it better?
Well, you know, he's saying that there is, I guess, when in the new Social Security plan, the casinoization, that they can pass down the benefits directly. If the mother dies, I think he's implying that she will get the money that was owed to her. Yet there is some of that. He mentioned also that there is some of that that goes on now. But you know what's disturbing here, Riley, is those numbers.
Oh, that, when you start talking about what people are saying about Bush's plan. This is according to a CNN USA Today Gallup poll that was released yesterday. More than two-thirds of those contacted from last Friday through Sunday, when Bush was actually in Omaha, said it would be a good idea to limit benefits for wealthier retirees and for higher income workers to pay pay higher Social Security taxes on all of their wages. Right
that's
now, the cap
bad.
Is $90,000.
That's a little socialism at work, kind of.
Well, yeah.
Let's take it from the rich. The thing that bothered me was the 64% that said they think it'll be bankrupt. See, that one bit of framing has gotten through.
Has gotten through. But, see, it's interesting. People are worried about that, but they're not at all sure that Bush's solution is the right solution. 55% of the respondents thought Bush's proposal for privatization would allow wage owners to invest, that would allow wage owners to invest in personal investment accounts is a bad idea.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't quite know how it works and they're not into it. But the frightening thing to me is that the base argument, which is a lie, it's built on a fallacy, it's not going to be bankrupt by that date. You know what I mean? It's not going to be able to pay out as well as it should, but it can be fixed through some payroll taxes adjustments. But that frame has gotten through.
And the American people realize the best way to deal with it, which is to increase the amount that wealthy people pay into the system.
Take it from the rich.
Yeah.
We'll be back with writer-activist Keith Boykin, who's going to talk about his book, Beyond the Down Low, Sex, Lies, and Denial in Black America.
Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
34 past the hour. I haven't heard this in a while. This is pretty good, huh, Mark Reyes?
I love it.
Mark Maron here. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We are going to be talking to Keith Boykin in a matter of moments. Right now, every week, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Thank you, Doug Krieger. Dateline, the fantasy world of George W. Bush, somewhere deep within a land of chocolate crucifixes, bow-legged cows, and the amazing talking tumbleweed.
Right.
4 years and 3 months ago, George Bush and his father's friends brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in stupidity and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created to serve apes. We are now engaged in a great civil war, where at times it seems, armed with mere reason, man has little chance against the ape with his superior weapons of banana, coconut, and hurled fecal matter. Item. This week, a hairy palm full of crap, otherwise known as the President's 2006 budget, was thrown directly into the hallowed halls of science and health. Intertwined within this steamy conglomeration of neocon values and undigested corn, wait for it, is the complete elimination of an indispensable program for the treatment of people with traumatic brain injuries. The total savings? $9 million. Chump change. The cost to humankind? No man can say. Shameful. Ignominious. Not satisfied with cutting America's science funding, destroying this nation's third-class educational system, or even replacing our drinking water with rocket fuel, our frivoling Texas tea bag of a president and his rump-fed myrmidons now turn their weird animal bloodlust towards the brain itself. No, not the fleeting notion of conceptual mind that can define the human soul in a Times bankroll Adam Sandler movie, but the actual physical object itself, the labyrinthian embranglement of pulsating macaroni, grits, and carpentry nails. I'm talking about the medulla oblongata, the cerebrum, hypothalamus, hippopotamus, porpotawatomy, and of course, the mysterious G-spot. All fall victim to George W. Bush's proposed 2006 budget, his Xanadu. The names of over 2 million Americans appeared on the list of traumatic brain injuries last year. If you were lucky enough to know Laura Bush back in high school, chances are even more parts of your skull appeared on her front bumper.
Yeah.
As a victim of traumatic brain injury myself, I would like to say I love to be beside your side, beside the seaside, by the beautiful sea. And that's why I have a metal plate in my head. What I'm trying to say is this. We should look on the bright side. With an extra $9 million lying around, maybe Bush can hire a fashion consultant for Dick Cheney so he doesn't show up to any more Holocaust ceremonies dressed like a circus whore. Until next time, freedom fighters, maybe you should think twice the next time you're at a party and you start pounding on a beer keg with a hammer. Because I love to be beside your side, beside the sea, beside your seaside, by the beautiful sea. And that's why I have a metal plate in my head. And that's today's dispatch from... And that's today's dispatch from... And that's today's dispatch from...
The War on Brains.
The metal plate in my head.
Wow. Hey, do you know, Mort, that you repeated yourself several times at the end?
I have a metal plate in my head.
Yeah, I know. We covered that. But you're aware that you're repeating yourself.
Daisy, Daisy.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Tell me your answer true.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Hey, how come I don't get a big produce to the intro like that last bit you did a few minutes ago?
There you go. That's your produced intro to get out.
See you later, Krieger.
Yeah, get out of here.
Wow.
Oh,
whatever.
Thank God. Our next guest has done many things. For 2 years, he served as a special assistant to President Clinton. He is also the president of the National Black Justice Coalition. He appeared on the Showtime series American Candidate, but right now we're here to talk about his book, Beyond the Down Low, Sex, Lies, and Denial in Black America. This hits bookshelves today. Welcome to the show, Keith Boykin. Nice to see you.
Good to be here, Mark. Thanks for being here.
So now this, what you're writing about is not a new thing. I mean, this has been going on since the beginning of gayness, I imagine. Yes?
You are exactly right. I mean, the down low is so not new, it's not even funny. It's something that has been going on since the beginning of time, actually. Mm-hmm. Men have been secretly sleeping with men, but they did not identify as gay.
Right.
The only thing that's new is that we're talking about it now with a new hot buzzword, the down low or the DL. But we used to call it the closet.
Right.
There you go.
It's just a new... Now, in these relationships, I mean, a lot of... I've heard... different things. I've heard that that you know it's aiding in the spreading of AIDS in the straight community. Do you believe that?
Absolutely not. In fact, there's no evidence to prove the DL, the down low, is responsible for the AIDS epidemic. We've actually seen a reduction in AIDS cases over the past dozen years in the African American community, and that's something that never gets talked about. There was a story just yesterday in the Washington Post that said HIV cases are soaring among black women. Completely not true. I talked to the CDC yesterday afternoon, and they told me that the actual number of AIDS cases, the AIDS rates, has actually declined for black women from 2000 to 2003.
Wow, the New York Post lying. Who knew?
No, Washington Post.
Oh, the Washington Post.
Yeah, the Washington Post. Yeah.
Why would they put that? That's ridiculous.
Well, it's part of this sort of this orchestrated campaign of fear. It's
okay.
A fear campaign directed at African American women, and it's in part it has the purpose or the effect of stigmatizing black sexuality. It stigmatizes black men as predators, and it stigmatizes black women as undesirable and therefore all disease. And we, unfortunately, who are African-American, have bought into the lies that have been used against us, and we have to challenge that.
I've got to establish something with you right off the top. What do you consider a man who sleeps both with women and with men? Is that person bisexual, gay, or straight?
Well, I would probably consider the person bisexual, but I think there's three different ways to look at it. You have to look at identity, orientation, and behavior, and those are three separate categories.
Well, we know about the behavior. You're doing both.
Well, the behavior would be bisexual, but the person may not identify as being bisexual, and their orientation may be homosexual, heterosexual, or bisexual. We don't really know. So there are three different ways to look at it, and it really depends on the individual person.
Now, why do you think it is? Because as Mark pointed out earlier, this is something that is not new. But what appears to be new is the idea that men who sleep with other men also sleep with the women. Certainly there have been a lot of closeted gay men who have had women that they've had relationships with to kind of showcase to the general public. But in many instances, they did not sleep with those women. Why has that changed?
Well, you know, I'm not even sure that it's changed, Mark. I think that what's changed is that we started talking about it a lot more in the past 15 years or so. Back in the early 1990s, Elin Harris published his first book, Invisible Life. And afterwards, he published Just As I Am. And he's published, I think, 8 novels now about black bisexuality. And I think that really brought it out into the open. In a way that had never been exposed before in our community. We had an impression that there were black gay men out there, but we didn't know that they were actually sleeping with women, some of them as well. And we knew that some of them were in the closet all along.
But what kind of woman would like not sleep with... I mean, how many times can you say, you know, let's do it tomorrow? I mean, for 30 years, you're telling me that you knew guys that were,
yes,
were actively
absolutely.
Gay and their wives, they didn't sleep together for 30 years?
The women didn't... See, there are some women in America that really don't care that much about sex. They really don't. And for them, a guy who doesn't make that demand on them is no big deal.
Well, what do? You just sort of hang out, or?
I'm not going to get into that. That's another discussion for another day, hopefully for another network. I don't know.
Now, let's talk about some differences in how blacks and whites perceive gayness.
Right,
within
right.
The community. I mean.
Well, you know, in the African-American community, we have sort of a don't ask, don't tell policy about homosexuality. You can look at the black church as an example. The black church is the most homophobic institution in the black community.
Yeah, but we'll be talking about the choir directly.
Right, exactly. It's also the most homo-tolerant institution in the community at the same time.
Yeah.
Homophobic on the one hand because the ministers will give their standard fire and brimstone sermons every now and then. And if you look behind the minister, the choir members, the choir directors, the musicians, the organists, we have black, gay, and bisexual men all throughout the churches. And we have this whole policy of disconnecting the reality from the rhetoric.
Let's talk about two issues that I think play into this. One is... the feeling on the part of a lot of black straight people that gays, and whether they be black or white, equate their struggle with the civil rights struggle, and people have a problem with that. Should they?
Well, no, I don't think that we should equate one struggle with another because each struggle is different. But I do think we can compare one struggle with another. And I think people confuse the words compare and equate. To compare just means to look at something and see the similarities and differences. Yes, you can compare the gay rights movement to the civil rights movement because there are similarities and there are differences. No, you can't equate them because no two movements are exactly the same. But listen to this. That's not even really the most important point. You know, we often get caught up in this whole comparison of our struggles to see, you know, my blues ain't like yours or your blues ain't like mine. And the truth is, these hierarchies of oppression don't help. It doesn't matter which group was first oppressed or which was most oppressed or whether they're even identically oppressed. What matters is that no group of people should be oppressed. And we lose sight of that too often.
You know, that's an important point. But it, one of the things that, and I, you know, having read a little bit about the history of the civil rights struggre, two people, Bayard Rustin and Audre Lorde.
Exactly.
Two people who were both gay. And who, and certainly in Bayard Rustin's case, were forced to take a back seat even in the March on Washington.
Well, Bayard Rustin was the chief architect and organizer of the 1963 March on Washington, where Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. He was also one of Dr. King's closest advisors. But because he was openly gay, that was used against him in the early 1960s, and people tried to push him out of his position, including A. Philip Randolph back in the day.
Yeah.
Not A. Philip Randolph, but others in the NAACP tried to push him back. But if you look at the history of the African-American community, we've always had this reality and the rhetoric that hasn't always been consistent. Not only Bayard Rustin, but also Audre Lorde and James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry. We have so many people who played an instrumental role. Billy Strayhorn, right, Duke Ellington's composer. We have a long history of African Americans who played a big role in our community who are also gay or lesbian or bisexual.
We're talking to writer and activist Keith Boykin. The book is Beyond the Down Low, Sex, Lies, and Denial in Black America. It's available at morningsedition.com for a slight discount. When we come back, I'd like to get into how the Bush administration is using homophobia within the black community to forward its own agenda. We'll be back in a minute. It's 46 past the hour.
morningsedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. morningsedition.com. Air America Radio.
Okay, we're going to try and land this thing. It's 50 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. The show is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Beyond the Download, Sex, Lies, and Denial in Black America. Keith Boykin is the author. He is also our guest. Before we get into how the Bush administration is exploiting homophobia within the black religious community, certainly, what are the differences in perception and how homosexuality is perceived within the black community and the white community, and why is it different?
The differences in perception in terms of...
Well, I mean, acceptance, and it just seems that there is a more of a code in the black community than there is in the white community. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, I think there's a common perception in the black community that homosexuality is something that we don't necessarily want to become prevalent. I mean, people, I think homophobia exists differently in the black community than it does in the white community. In the black community, it's not so much a fear of homosexuality, it's a fear that homosexuality would become widespread. And we all are sort of obsessed with this whole notion of perpetuating and promoting the black family, and we think that somehow homosexuality is inconsistent with that. And yet at the same time, there are a lot of black gay men and lesbians who are raising their nieces and nephews and raising their sisters' kids and their brothers' kids, and we have to acknowledge that is going on. We don't want to talk about that.
Well, that's interesting because, as you said before, there is a certain amount of knowing and there's a certain amount of accepting on the social level, yet it seems that the black clergy is willing to sort of, you know, make an alliance with the Republican administration around this fear of homosexuality.
Well, you know, the black community has always been politically progressive but socially conservative, and that's one of the issues that people need to understand when talking about the church. On the one hand, we're politically progressive when it comes to voting for candidates and so forth. We always vote Democratic in most presidential elections, but we're socially conservative on a lot of the big moral issues, abortion, homosexuality. We support civil rights for gays and lesbians, but we don't necessarily support relationships for gays and lesbians sometimes. And that's not for everyone, too. We have to understand there's diversity in the black community. People like Coretta Scott King and Julian Bond and Al Sharpton and Carol Moseley Braun have been very, very supportive for civil rights for gays and lesbians.
Keith, how has the whole idea that this down low phenomenon, which is the subject of your book, Beyond the Down Low, how has it gotten tied into this whole notion of the spread of AIDS, because I think that's a really, really insidious connection that is not supported by a great number of facts, but it is a pretty widespread perception right now.
Well, you're right. There's a few people who are misinformed opportunists who are spreading this lie, quite frankly.
And that guy...
J.L. King is one of those people, quite frankly. You know, he's misinformed. He's an opportunist. He's using this to make some money to spread his misinformation. But the truth is there's no evidence to back it up. There's no evidence to prove that the download is responsible for the AIDS epidemic, and especially not even among black women. Look at this. In 2003, there were 7,000 black female AIDS cases reported to the CDC. That's the most recent year for which we have full data. Out of that 7,000 cases, guess how many reported sex with a bisexual male as a method of exposure? 118.
Out of 7,000.
Out of 7,000. That's 1.6% of all cases. That's ridiculous that we're even focusing so much energy on this when it's only 1.6% of all black female cases. Not to mention the fact that there are twice as many black men who are diagnosed with AIDS every year than black women. But we don't want to talk about that because we're afraid that if we do, we have to talk about homosexuality and bisexuality. Nobody wants to discuss that. So we really have to deal with our homophobia first.
How do you see Nelson Mandela? I know this is an international issue, not just a national one, but how do you see Nelson Mandela's public acknowledgement of his son's AIDS as impacting? Because there was somebody in Britain that was a member of parliament that came out and said Mandela was the reason why.
Well, I think Nelson Mandela is an incredibly important figure, and when he says something, it makes a big difference. When he came out and announced that his son had AIDS, I think it really dramatized the issue in a way that it wouldn't have come home for a lot of people. In the same way that Magic Johnson's disclosure in 1991 helped to dramatize the issue for African Americans. So I think it's going to make an impact even in the months and years to come.
Do you think that particularly in Magic Johnson's case, because I remember the rumors that swirled around Magic Johnson just before and after the announcement. Do you think that sort of thing still happens in the black community, that if someone, a public male figure, announces they are HIV positive, that people immediately assume that that person is either gay or bisexual?
I think that does happen a lot. It happened with Max Robinson back in the 1980s. It happened with Magic Johnson. It didn't happen with Arthur Ashe only because he was
a blood transfusion, and everybody knew, yeah.
And it happened with Eazy-E, the rapper, when he died of AIDS. So it's going to happen because there's an association that AIDS equals gay, even though it's certainly not always the case.
So Keith Boykin, just quickly, what do you hope that people's reaction to the book will be, and what do you hope to achieve with the book?
Well, so far the reaction has been very positive. The reviews have been positive. The public has responded well to it. I hope that people will start to think critically about what they've been told, and that they understand that knowledge is power. And we stop demonizing men on the down low and vilifying black men, and start to really understand how we could take positive steps to create solutions.
Great. Keith Boykin, thank you so much for being with us. Beyond the Download, Sexwise and Denial in Black America is the book. It's available at morningsedition.com. It was great to talk to you.
Great to be here, Mark.
Appreciate
Mark.
You being here. That's it. We sign it for me?
Oh, sure.
Okay, all right. So what do we got?
There it is.
The liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. 1. This year for Lent, don't give up anything. We've given up enough in the last 12 months, don't you think? 2. Start a fake faith-based initiative just so you can get government funding. 3. To celebrate the Chinese New Year, rent a tank and restage the Tiananmen Square standoff. That's going to take some doing. 4. Stop eating at tapas bars. America has to wean itself from dependence on foreign olive oil. Hello? Anything? No? All right. 5. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Hey, Bush, so having 3 jobs is uniquely American, huh? You know what else is uniquely American? Impeachment, man. Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. What do we got tomorrow there, Riley?
Tomorrow we're going to talk about a very serious subject that I hadn't heard about in a long time, thalidomide, a drug that was given to pregnant women in the 1960s. We're going to be talking to Matt Frazier, a victim of that drug and star of the new play, The Flid Show.
Not going to be heavy. He's got a sort of an entertaining spin on the physical ailment that came with thalidomide. He doesn't want that show about it. Good talking to you, Riley.
Good talking to you. It was a lot of fun. Good talking to Keith Boykin. We'll be back tomorrow to do it all again here on Air America Radio.